Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. A purge in the Department of Homeland Security. Last week, President Trump pulled his nominee to lead Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Then Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen resigned Sunday after a meeting with the president. And then President Trump announced the removal of the director of the United States Secret Service. That's not all. There are rumors, too, that other top officials could be dismissed soon. Now, the president has a right to fill the executive branch with people who can help him fulfill his goals. And right now, he's focused on getting tougher on immigration. But is the purge causing too much disruption in Homeland Security? Even some congressional Republicans worry about that. So could it backfire on the president? This hour on Point, President Trump, the border, and Homeland Security. And you can join us. What do you make of the shakeup in DHS leadership? Are you confident new leaders can solve the problems at the border? And do you think we need officials who will be, quote, tougher on immigration, as President Trump has said? Join us anytime on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining us first from Washington is Nick Miroff, national security correspondent who covers immigration enforcement, drug trafficking, and the Department of Homeland Security for The Washington Post. We have links to his reporting on DHS at our website, onpointradio.org. Nick, welcome to On Point.
Thanks. It's good to be with you.
So first of all, tell us, where are we at in terms of the shakeup in leadership at DHS? Will the president be able to install his new acting director as he'd like to do?
I mean, it's just been a dizzying period of several days here. You know, as you mentioned, the White House's nominee to lead Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, his name was withdrawn late last week. And then the Secretary of Homeland Security, Kirstjen Nielsen, goes to this meeting with the president Sunday and, you know, walks out essentially without a job. And then just yesterday, we see the director of the Secret Service go down. You know, since the creation of the Department of Homeland Security in the wake of 9/11, we have never seen this kind of purge or this level of instability. I mean, keep in mind that is that is one of the first nominees that a new president usually puts forward during a period of transition in order to reassure the country that things are safe and that somebody is protecting the country. And you know, right now we're at a period of extraordinary instability. And as you know, DHS officials told us yesterday, they're decapitating the entire department.
So what effect is that having? What are people within DHS saying about the instability is causing inside the department?
You know, I think it's just it sends a signal of of a certain degree of of chaos, but also I think what's going on here is that the president and the White House are obviously very frustrated with the immigration situation, and they see the Homeland Security Department as still very much the legacy of John Kelly's tenure there, mm-hmm. and they're determined to sweep it out right now and to put new people in. The problem for the president is that if he names figures who are the kind of darlings of the hard right, particularly on immigration, then he's going to have an especially difficult path to Senate confirmation. His naming of the CBP commissioner, Kevin McAleenan, as the acting director of DHS, I think was an attempt to have some degree of stability. What's mm-hmm. unclear at this point is whether McAleenan will be the nominee for the full-time role or if he's merely a placeholder until the White House can get someone more palatable to the kind of border hawks, that are being pushed right. by advisors like Stephen Miller.
Well, so let me ask about the naming of McAleenan, because I think it seems chaotic how all of this was done, right? Because former Secretary Nielsen's resignation letter said she would officially resign on April 7th. She tweeted out, though, that she's staying until April 10th, which is tomorrow, in order to assure an orderly transition at DHS. And part of the question is, can the president even name McAleenan to be the new acting director? Because there is still a current acting deputy secretary, Claire Grady, in place at DHS, and that she would have to resign or be fired in order for the president to be able to name McAleenan as the new acting secretary. I mean, what is going on there?
That's right. Not too orderly. Indeed, our understanding is that Claire Grady is in line to take over DHS. She will have to resign, or if she doesn't go quietly, she will be fired as soon as today.
Okay. So is there a sense that this was all planned out, or these were sort of legal hurdles that the administration didn't anticipate in this big shakeup?
You know, I think that these appear to be, you know, unanticipated consequences. I mean, one of the things that's so striking about this level of instability and this widening purge is that the White House has communicated so little about its rationale for doing so. I mean, you can understand that the president is frustrated about the numbers at the border and wants an immigration shakeup. And yet yesterday he just takes out the head of the Secret Service. So, you know, and really without much explanation. And so I think one of the things that has added to the fog and sense of chaos about this, particular process is that so little is being communicated about the reasoning behind it.
Okay. So Nick Miroff, national security correspondent for The Washington Post. Hang on here for just a second, because I want to turn now, or I want to bring into the conversation, Gabby Orr, also joining us from Washington. She's the White House reporter for Politico. We have a link to her story, which is headlined, "Stephen Miller Pressuring Trump Officials Amid Immigration Shakeups." That link is at our website, onpointradio.org. Gabby Orr, it's good to have you.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay, so give us some insight here into these big questions that Nick is asking about. Why is this happening right now? What role does White House advisor Stephen Miller, what role is he playing in all of this?
Well, the president has essentially put Stephen Miller in charge of his immigration policy going forward. And as we know, just from months and months of reporting on this administration, Stephen Miller has a very different idea of how the president and his administration should approach the situation at the border and immigration policy more broadly than did, former Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen and others within her agency and across the administration. And so now he's sort of pushing to oust a number of individuals who he thinks are insufficiently aggressive in terms of addressing the problem at the border. He wants to basically revamp the Homeland Security Department to make it so it'll be easier to move forward with some of these executive actions or agenda items that he and the president really want to get done. And for the most part, he's looking to push out officials who have previously told both Stephen Miller and President Trump these are things that cannot be done outside, that they would occur outside of the law, that you need congressional approval, or that it would be better to have Congress handle things. And so it seems as though, based on our reporting, based on what we're hearing from officials at DHS, that the president, that Stephen Miller, are tired of being told no, and that's what's leading to this so-called purge that's happening.
Okay, so I'm seeing here some reporting that says that the president said in an Oval Office meeting that Miller was basically now in charge of White House immigration initiatives. Is the power being consolidated around him to that degree?
Well, Miller is definitely a key player in immigration policy, but, you know, it's important not to forget that President Trump is the one guiding all of this. Mm-hmm. So, yes, Miller is essentially calling the shots, but all of that is coming down from the top. And this is because of the reaction that President Trump has been seeing just in the past 2 to 3 weeks among his more hardline conservative supporters. He's been tuning into Fox News. He's been listening to conservative talk radio. He's, you know, an avid viewer of Lou Dobbs' show on Fox Business. And he has been criticizing the way that this administration, in particular Secretary Nielsen, have addressed the quote-unquote humanitarian crisis at the border. And so, you know, as we know, President Trump is just a vociferous consumer of the news and of the media. And if he watches these headlines and watches these critics and people who are close to his administration repeatedly panning what's happening, he felt compelled, and as did Stephen Miller, to take action to change it.
So, Gabby, though, what are some of the responses from other members of the administration, from inside the White House, about all that's been going on? Because I'm seeing here a quote from an unnamed administration official who was rather critical of Stephen Miller, talking about Ron Vitiello, if I'm saying his name right. He was the president's former ICE nominee. He said Vitiello has spent as much time defending our nation's borders as Stephen Miller has been alive, said this unnamed official who's been quoted. I mean, so are people a little, I don't know, are they feeling upset about how quickly the pace of change is happening?
They're upset. They're confused. And it's not just people inside the administration. It's also some of these allied groups. These are groups like the Center for Immigration Studies, Numbers USA, the Federation for American Immigration Reform. These are far-right immigration groups that have been extremely supportive of the president's immigration agenda, but are starting to draw a line with what's happening in his administration. As we know, just based on reporting over the past few days, one of the people that Stephen Miller is sort of looking to push out or is targeting is Francis Cisna, the head of U.S. Citizen and Immigration Services. And this is another individual, just like Ron Vitiello, who these groups feel as though he's done as much as he can in his job. They've been extremely satisfied with his work sort of behind the scenes to advance the Trump immigration agenda. And they're confused and they oppose any effort to push him out of his role.
Right. So, Nick Miroff, we just have a minute to go before we have to take a break here. But as Gabby said, the president is tired of being told no, but a lot of what he's being told no by or no about are things like, you know, he wanted to shut down the southern border, federal judge yesterday ruling that he can't prevent asylum seekers from being in the United States as they wait for their asylum hearings. I mean, he's being told no because some of his decisions are either unrealistic or not legal. So what's going to change?
Right. He's being told no by the judicial branch of the United States. And that is essentially setting up a potentially escalating clash, because a lot of the things that involve getting tough are simply not legal.
Well, Nick Miroff with The Washington Post and Gabby Orr with Politico, stand by. We are talking about President Trump's big shakeup in the Department of Homeland Security and how he's trying to put in more people who will help him get, quote, tougher on immigration. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about President Donald Trump's big shakeup at the Department of Homeland Security. And we're joined today by Nick Miroff. He's a national security correspondent who covers immigration enforcement, drug trafficking, and the Department of Homeland Security for The Washington Post. Gabby Orr is also with us as well. She's White House reporter for Politico. Do you think the president's right in trying to bring in people who he believes will be, quote, tougher on immigration? Or is this lack of stability, and in words of people inside the department, this decapitation inside DHS, is it only going to make the president's goals harder to achieve? Well, let's listen to the president himself, because on Friday, he was at a border security roundtable in Calexico, California, and the president said there's, quote, a colossal surge of migrants at the border.
The system is full. can't take you anymore. Whether it's asylum, whether it's anything you want, it's illegal immigration, can't take you anymore. We can't take you. Our country is full. Our area is full. The sector is full. Can't take you anymore. I'm sorry. Can't happen. So turn around. That's the way it is.
That's President Trump on Friday in California. And I should note that two sources told CNN that during that visit, or after the cameras got turned off, the president told border agents to not let migrants in. Quote, tell them we don't have the capacity, the president said. If judges give you trouble, the president said he told the border agents, tell the judges, sorry, I can't do it. We don't have the room. Now, CNN is also reporting that after the president left the room, agents sought further advice from their leaders on what to do, and their leaders told them they were not giving them that direction about telling judges that they, quote, couldn't do it. And if they did what the president said, they would be taking on a personal liability. You have to follow the law, they were told. That was according to CNN. Now, Nick Miroff, I wanted to sort of pull that CNN reporting in because I wonder what people inside DHS, even the rank and file, are saying about how the tumult and the chaos is affecting their ability to do their jobs, to even right now, just the basic sort of border protection duties that they have on a daily basis.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is a sense that, what we're seeing is the executive branch is kind of throwing things at the wall, attempting to push, increasingly harsh policy proposals and ideas that are simply unworkable or are illegal. We see them come out with something with great fanfare like this, like the Remain in Mexico, program. And then almost invariably it gets blocked in the Ninth Circuit, by a federal judge. And so, you know, what we're really running up against are the limits of the White House and the executive branch and just ordering, tough policy solutions to this without working with Congress to get some kind of compromise solution that will have the backing of the law.
So running up against the supposed limits of a Republican, small r Republican system of government.
Yeah, I sometimes wonder, in the way that we recall, the idea that only Nixon could have gone to China and do this kind of opening, I think what we're seeing are the limits of a president who uses really inflammatory rhetoric to talk about immigration, the limits of a leader like that to get a kind of border security in place, because you have to get moderates on board. You have to be able to create a space, I think, for Democrats to work with the administration. And the president simply is not leaving much room for that, because at this point right now, ahead of the 2020 election, what are the incentives? What are the motivations for Democrats of almost any moderate across the spectrum? What is their motivation to partner with the president on any kind of immigration solution?
Right. Well, let's go to the phones really quickly. Let's go to Emily, who's calling from Cape Elizabeth, Maine. Emily, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks so much. I'm wondering why President Trump and his advisors like Stephen Miller keep clearing house, getting rid of people like Kirstjen Nielsen, when it's apparent to everybody except for apparently them that it's the judicial branch that is causing, that it's limiting their ability to make these hardliner moves. It seems like no matter who Trump appoints as Secretary of DHS, he's going to receive those same checks from federal judges. So what's the point in getting rid of someone who is, in many ways exactly what he wants just because she tells him no? I mean, it's not her that's really saying no, it's the judicial branch.
Mm. Emily, thank you so much for your call. Gabby Orr, do you have a thought on that?
I think that he feels as though there's people like Kirstjen Nielsen who have told him even before he decided to move ahead with an action that was eventually struck down by the courts or tied up in the courts, that just being told no by these figures who recognize that that was the likely path if he took these actions was enough to just frustrate him and eventually build up to the point where he felt like he needed to get essentially some more yes men in his administration. He doesn't want to be told that, this needs to happen inside Congress or you cannot do that and expect that you are not going to face a number of lawsuits against it. He wants to be told that, Mr. President, you can go ahead and do whatever it is you want on immigration. And yes, there might be consequences, but let's, you know, take those moves and figure out after the fact what has happened. And you know, I think Nielsen was one of those figures who just time and time again warned him of the consequences of some of his actions. Stephen Miller, on the other side of the spectrum, is somebody who, you know, often encourages President Trump to do things that he knows are contentious, mm-hmm. That he knows will be caught up in the courts, but to go ahead and pursue them anyway and deal with the consequences later on.
All right. Well, we'll turn to that thought in a moment here, because I think, you know, we should explore more that if Miller and the president really want to accomplish these big goals, to go in continuously in this direction of provocation and losing court battles, you got to wonder what the long-term effectiveness of it is and whether they might change tack. But Gabby, I did want to explore with both you and Nick sort of how congressional Republicans are responding to all of this. Because, first of all, let's just listen to what Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell had to say last Tuesday when the president began talking about shutting down the southern border. Mitch McConnell did not like that idea.
We certainly have a crisis at the border. I think the president's right about that. Closing down the border would have potentially catastrophic economic impact on our country. And I would hope we would not be doing that.
That's Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell last week. And in the wake of all the upheaval in DHS leadership this week, we hear folks such as Senator John Cornyn saying it's a mess. Joni Ernst of Iowa. Senator Ernst says, I thought that Nielsen was doing a fantastic job. I would love to see some continuity. I think that's important. Senator Chuck Grassley says the president has to have some stability, and particularly with the number one issue he's made for his campaign throughout his 2.5 years of his presidency. Grassley went on to say he's pulling the rug out from the very people that are trying to help him accomplish his goal. So, Gabby Orr, where is all of this putting congressional Republicans?
Well, they are in a particularly difficult position because they know that the president likes to talk about immigration as he leads up to different elections. He did this before the 2018 midterms. He's planning to do it again as he heads into his reelection campaign. And it does put them in a spot where, you know, they would much prefer to be talking about the state of the economy, about tax reform, what Republicans have been able to do with their Senate majority and with the presidency over the past 2 years. And yet they're continuing to be asked these questions, not just by reporters, but by their Democratic colleagues as to why the president is pursuing this sort of chaos-driven strategy. Why is he suddenly in his, you know, the third year of his first term, completely purging the Homeland Security Department of individuals who have done a satisfactory job, at least to the standards held by these congressional Republicans for the past 2 years? And especially, why is he doing it as we head into another election cycle? You know, Grassley has pushed back pretty significantly in the past 2 days against any effort to oust Francis Cisna from USCIS. He has, you know, Cisna is a former aide to Grassley. He was an immigration policy advisor to him. And he has essentially put his foot down and said that there will be significant problems and tension between the White House and Senate Republicans if this continues.
Yeah. So, Gabby and Nick, hang on here for just a second, because I want to bring into the conversation John Sandweg. He also joins us from Washington. He's former acting director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, under President Obama, and former top aide to then Department of Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano. John Sandweg, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So you've been inside the department as a pretty high-level person. I mean, I asked Nick this, but I'm trying to get a sense as to what all this tumult and chaos and turnover, what effect that's having on the department itself. I mean, what do you think?
Well, it creates a lot of uncertainty, to be sure. And you have to understand that when a secretary goes like this, so will a cadre of her top advisors who are dealing with, you know, on a day-to-day basis with the career folks. So, you know, it creates a concern about, you know, certainly the concerns about the stability, I think, are well placed. And then questions arise about the new crop of leaders. How long are you going to be here? And do you really have the backing of this White House and this administration? So it only makes the president's goals, if the goals are to actually stop this flow, this mass migration happening at the border, that much harder to implement.
But of course, the president does have the right to choose leadership in the executive branch that will help him achieve his policy goals. And so, you know, we've been talking repeatedly how he's felt frustrated and stymied on that front. So if you were to be advising the president right now about, you know, what you think the best way to achieve these goals on being, you know, quote unquote, tougher on immigration, what would you advise he do instead of this?
Well, I mean, look, all this talk about toughness really is just, in my mind, you know, a soundbite and not really a strategy. There is an existing framework of laws to deal with a crisis like this. The one thing this president hasn't tried to do is actually enforce those laws. The problem is not the numbers of people showing up at the border. We've dealt with more people in the history of you know, the border with far fewer resources. We had about 1.5 million apprehensions in the early 2000s with only about 5,000 Border Patrol agents. The problem here is that these people are coming from Central America, not Mexico, which makes it more challenging to remove them, and they're all claiming asylum. So now you have backlogs that have formed in the immigration courts, over a million cases with about 350 judges. So what does that mean? It means that individuals who get into the country, claim asylum, who can't be removed until they have their immigration court hearing, are now waiting 3, 4, 5 years before they have that hearing. So it seemed like the easy solution is recognizing that the situation at the border has changed over the last 4 to 5 years. So we want to surge resources in to adjudicate those cases, those asylum claims, as quickly as possible. Instead, I think this White House just seems to refuse to accept the validity of the asylum laws, and instead continues to try these peripheral attacks under the guise of toughness, family separation, remain in place, that are unlawful, and have been held so by the courts, but also have been incompetently, you know, administered with, you know, if you look at family separation, where we still have parents and children who haven't been reunited, and we're not exactly sure where, you know, either the parents are or the child is, you know, or rolled out in a way that surprised the actual career folks and the operational folks who have to implement these policies.
Right.
And now we're firing the entire leadership because the strategy pushed by the White House predictably failed. And I think because they obstructed other kind of, if you will, inane ideas like, well, let's close the border, when, A, that'll cause great economic harm to the country and has no rational connection to what's going on between the ports of entry with Central American mass migration.
All right. Let's go to the phones really quickly. Let's go to Sid, who's calling from Detroit, Michigan. Sid, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. My point is that this is all subterfuge for the president. It's the new reality. It's like a reality TV show. He changes people at will. And what it does as subterfuge is to say that it's not that my policies are failing, it's that the people around me are failing. So it sets him up for the next election cycle where he can say, you know, I've tried everything that I could. And not only did the Democrats in the court stop me, but the people that were in place were not the right people, and therefore I, the president, had to fire him. It also helps him to maintain power, because if you don't have anybody in a particular position for a long enough time to understand what they need to do for immigration or any other issue, it consolidates power in the hands of one person, that being the president. So you eliminate all other administrative angles and all other administrative points of view into any one issue. So I'd like to hear a little bit about my idea that this is merely subterfuge. It doesn't matter who he puts in. They all do his bidding, but his bidding can't be done, and therefore he blames it on the people he puts in office.
Sid, thank you for your call. Nick Miroff, let me turn back to you because we haven't heard from you in a while. This is sort of the second time we've coming around to this, but people seem genuinely confused about this issue.
Yeah, I mean, I think the caller makes a great point. I think, and just let's take a look at what happened just now with the White House's nominee to lead ICE, Ron Vitello. Here you have a guy who's a 30-year veteran of the United States Border Patrol, and the White House gets behind his nomination, lobbies for his nomination, puts the Senate committee through the whole process of holding hearings, getting him confirmed. He's on track to be confirmed as the first Senate-confirmed ICE director since the president took office. And then without explanation, the White House just pulls his nomination on a Thursday night and says that they want to go in a tougher direction, but without really saying what tougher means or what about Ron Vitello, again, a 30-year veteran of the U.S. Border Patrol, what about him is simply not tough enough. So what sign of signal does that send to your career experienced leaders throughout the Homeland Security Department? It just says you can be yanked at any reason without any explanation. So, you know, I think that, you know, that kind of signal is very, you know, it's going to be unhealthy for your country's top security agency.
Right. Gabior, I know we've got to let you go in a couple of minutes here. So, I mean, can you, given your reporting and what your sources have been telling you, can you make sense of that, that change of heart regarding the president's former nominee to head ICE?
Well, you know, I had heard earlier this week that Vitello had been advising the president against full closure of the border. This is something that President Trump was obviously talking about last week before he backed away from it and said, we'll give, you know, Mexico and some of these other Central American countries a year's time to figure out how they can help address this situation down at the border before we either impose auto tariffs or shut down or partially or entirely shut down the border. And this was something that Vitello had told President Trump is not a wise move. It was something that Secretary Nielsen had also weighed in on and advised the president against doing. And so that was one of the reasons why he ultimately axed that nomination.
Well, Gabby Orr, White House reporter for Politico, with us from Washington today. We have links to her reporting at onpointradio.org. Gabby, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks again for having me.
And Nick Miroff and John Sandweg, stand by here for just a moment. We do have to take a quick break. We're talking about the president's shakeup at the Department of Homeland Security and whether or not it will help him or hinder him in achieving his goals about being, quote unquote, tougher on immigration. We'll be back. This is On Point.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breidinger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for craveable, hand-battered, cooked-to-order chicken fingers.
Chicken up.
Crispy, crinkle-cut fries.
Hot potato coming through.
Buttery Texas toast.
Toast walking.
And secret Cane's sauce.
Topping off now.
Turbocharge your chicken fingers and get them even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app.
Go, go, go!
Raising Cane's chicken fingers. One love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
The most exciting part of a vacation stay at a home rental? Easy. It's being greeted upon arrival with a rusted lockbox affixed to the underside of a stranger's condo. Yeah, you simply twist knobs, click gears, jiggle it, and then rip it off its moorings, and voila! Your prize is a key to a questionable home rental and maybe tetanus. When you just want to get your vacation started by actually getting into your room, it matters where you stay. At Hilton, we deliver your key right to your phone on the Hilton Honors app. Hilton for the stay.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about President Trump's shakeup of leadership at the Department of Homeland Security and what effect that's having in his desire to reach some greater goals, some tougher goals, as he calls them, for immigration in the United States. We're joined this hour by Nick Miroff. He's national security correspondent covering immigration enforcement, drug trafficking, and the Department of Homeland Security for The Washington Post. We're also joined by John Sandweg, former acting director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement under President Obama, and a former top aide to then Department of Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano. And John, let me just turn back to you here for a second to explore a little bit more about what the president's actually trying to accomplish here. Because I think, let's give him credit, he's been very transparent about it. We heard that tape a little earlier in the hour when he was in California saying he just believes that the country is quote unquote full, that there's no room, meaning doesn't want asylum seekers, doesn't want migrants, basically wants to shut immigration down. He's been transparent about that. So is the – and if that's his goal, is the problem the goal itself and that he's just going to run up into a hard wall of reality? Or is there a way for him to – any feasible way for him to achieve that goal?
You know, Meghna, it's funny. I mean, first of all, I don't think that goal is – admirable. I think that obviously immigration brings a lot of vitality to this country. But setting that aside for a moment, if I was advising the president, saying that, you know, if he asked me, what is the number one way I can achieve my goals? It's quite simple. It would be beefing up the immigration courts. And I know it doesn't sound tough. It's not something that politicians are going to run on and be elected with. But if you look at what is the choke point in the U.S. immigration enforcement system, it's those immigration courts. It's, you know, the over majority of people who enter the United States or are here unlawfully need to see an immigration judge, are required by law to see an immigration judge before they were removed. Now, the president's been clear. He wants those laws to be changed. Mm-hmm. But the practical reality is, if you're the president, is that the House Democrats are never going to support such a change like that. It's unclear that the Senate would even support a change like that, much less that it would be constitutional to eliminate due process for migrants. So working within the realities of the current system, it's clear that you need a massive infusion of immigration judges to process cases. He just steadfastly refuses to do this. Instead, he's trying to deter his way out of this through this tough approach. But I think what we've seen with the escalating numbers is that deterrence is ineffective when people are fleeing this incredible, horrific situation in Central America. And it's not a surprise to me that the president's removal numbers, and again, I don't think this is something to congratulate him on or necessarily criticize him for, but his deportation numbers are actually at the lowest levels in history.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a direct result of his policies and also his refusal to resource the immigration courts to process more cases.
Yeah, so let's not forget that President Obama was called the deporter-in-chief for many years of his administration. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Mary, who's calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Mary, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I just have a question, a couple of comments. The question is, this issue has happened in the era of Obama. And the second thing is, I was wondering, why are you looking at a one-sided and not on both-sided? Don't you think we have issue with drugs? Don't you think we have an issue of too many illegal immigrants? And the thing is that I'm very concerned is by only showing one-sided, you're creating a lot of division between the country.
Mm. Mary, hang on here for just a second, Mary, because let's take each of your questions one by one. First, you said, did this issue happen under Obama? Which issue are you talking about specifically?
The illegal immigration.
Did illegal immigration happen under President Obama? Okay, so hang on here, Mary. Don't hang up. John Sandweg, give us the context of what illegal immigration was like under President Obama.
Well, this crisis with the Central American crisis began in 2014 under President Obama. But the reality is that illegal migration in the United States has actually been flat or declining since 2009. There's about 11.5 million, estimates plus or minus undocumented immigrants in the United States. By all studies, about 86% of them have been in the United States since at least 2006. So there certainly is a large population of undocumented, illegal migrants in the United States. However, that population has been here for a long time, and the good news is, because of the resources and investments we've made in border security, that population has not grown over the last 10 years.
Okay, so Mary, what do you think about that? You okay with that?
My question, I'm okay with it, but why you're saying that it's getting, there is a chaos in here right now? Is it doubling more than the Obama era? And on that time, the border security was okay. Why it is not the border security okay with Trump?
Well, John Sandweg, is what you're saying is that the border security is still okay, but it's the manner in which the Trump administration is, sort of changing rules around, the family separation example?
Megan, I think what the president tries to do is try to lump border security into one kind of big box, right? What we're dealing with here is a different and distinct issue. This is what I would call a mass migration, a humanitarian crisis. And in a very technical sense, the people who are arriving at the border and filing these asylum claims, we're not having a problem apprehending them, taking their biometrics, getting biographic information on them, putting them through health screening. We're only having a problem processing their legal claims for asylum, which under current law they have every right to make. So this is not an expansion of illegal migration, and it's a radically different problem than the problem that I think we're all used to facing at the border. Now, if my biggest criticism of the administration, however, is that the president continues to want to use security-based approaches that are effective, but against a different threat.
Right.
They were effective against what we faced in the mid-2000s when you had large numbers of primarily Mexican nationals crossing the border, trying to evade capture and get into to the United States. These folks, what I think people don't realize is the Central Americans cross into the United States, they are surrendering right away to a Border Patrol agent and making their asylum claim. And that's what's frustrating, is why aren't we not resourcing for the new challenges we're facing at the border, instead trying these old approaches, which have proven to be ineffective.
Yeah. So, Mary, I want to allow us to explore what your second question was fairly. So you said, I believe, why do you not care about drugs? Why are you trying to divide the country? Who's the you're referring to?
The media. I don't think the media is saying the correct things. They're only looking at one-sided. There is crisis in the border. There is crisis with illegal immigration, and they know the loophole that we have, that they can come with a child but why don't you try to help the president to find a solution? Why you're saying he's just winning 2020, it's all his rhetoric. Why don't you think that he loves the country and he's fighting to protect the citizens of all these people that have been killed?
Yeah, so Mary, I appreciate your perspective here. First of all, I mean, just speaking for myself, I don't think my duty is whether or not to question whether the president loves the country, but rather to provide fair analysis of his actions, his decisions, and his policy as president of the United States. And we've been trying to do that pretty robustly from all angles with all sorts of voices, including yours, over the past many months. So I just want to say thank you so much for your call and for your perspective as well. Nick Miroff, let me turn back to you here, because we should talk about the fact that the president who wants to put a new person in as head as DHS. And this is someone, Kevin McAleenan, who is actually quite well respected on both sides of the aisle in Washington. So tell us a little bit about McAleenan and what kind of stability, if he is approved as new DHS chief, what kind of stability he might provide.
Sure. Well, McAleenan is a very interesting figure. One administration official who doesn't work at CBP told me he considers him the most competent and intelligent and effective public servant in the entire federal government, with maybe the exception of General Dunford, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. So here's a guy who, as a longtime CBP official, trained as an attorney. The president likes him because he kind of looks like a tough guy. He's got short hair and a kind of stern manner, but he's got a law degree from Chicago. He reads academic research about what's driving migration. And I went with him to Central America last fall on a trip where he met with leaders from the governments in those nations, as well as community leaders, to try to get a better sense of what was driving people to go. So here you have a guy who's very curious, who's thoughtful, and who has support on both sides. Received a presidential rank award from President Obama in 2015, and has also obviously got a lot of support from Republican senators. Again, the question is going to be: Is he going to be the nominee that the White House wants to go with on a permanent basis, or is he just a kind of a placeholder right now to reassure everyone that there's someone with experience right now at the top of DHS, at least in the interim, until they can pick somebody who's going to be more palatable to the hardline side.
Yeah, so let's listen to a little bit about how McAleenan even talks about issues of immigration and border security, because he is commissioner of U.S. Customs and Border Protection, and he was at a Senate hearing last month talking about ways to address challenges at the border.
We must work with President López Obrador's administration in Mexico to address the transnational criminal organizations that are profiting and preying on migrants. And we must invest in border security, a modern border barrier system, additional agents and officers, additional technology at and between ports of entry, and air and marine support. And we must also have a whole of U.S. government approach to address children's unique medical needs and the undeniable humanitarian challenges we are facing.
That's U.S. Customs and Border Protection Chief Kevin McAleenan at a Senate hearing just last month. John Sandwig, what's your view of McAleenan, and if he does indeed get named as the new DHS head, what he could do there?
Well, I spent several years working with Kevin, and I agree with Nick. He's an incredibly impressive guy, incredibly intelligent, incredibly competent. Secretary Napolitano thought very highly of him, and I know Secretary Johnson did as well. Look, at the end of the day, though, the question here is how much authority will he have to implement his vision of border security? It seems like a lot of the decisions are being driven out of the White House. It would obviously behoove the White House to listen very closely to someone like Kevin, who has a deep understanding of these issues and how to best secure the border. So, look, if there's a silver lining to the chaos, it's that Kevin McAleenan was put in charge. Mm-hmm. But in terms of his effectiveness, I think that's going to be decided by the White House.
Back to the phones we go. Rhodes is calling from New Orleans. Rhodes, you're on the air.
Hi. I had a question. So it seems like the DHS shakeup kind of reflects Trump hitting kind of the wall, or the White House hitting the wall of their legal authority to take this hardline approach. And I was wondering what a more proactive kind of foreign policy and border management policy would have looked like had we had people thinking about this in terms of management rather than security.
Yeah,
that's my question.
Well, Rhodes, thank you so much for your call. John Sandweg, you've made this point a couple of times insofar as radically increasing the number of immigration judges, for example. But Rhodes also mentioned foreign policy. We had the president just recently, you know, cutting foreign aid through the State Department to several Central American countries here. Do you see that as effective or not?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that if you were asking me what are the worst things we could do, that would certainly be near the top of the list. Unless and until we stabilize the situation, and again, it's not our responsibility, and I can understand people being frustrated with this. Well, like, why should my taxpayer dollars go to restoring law and order in countries like Central America? But the practical reality is that because of the violence in Central America, because of the poverty, those people are coming to our border and crossing our border. And that is, even though I think the solutions to deal with it, they're expensive solutions. So it makes every sense in the world for us to continue to invest and try to stabilize those countries. I think you look no further than the history of migration from Mexico. Beginning in about 2011-12, you saw economic gains in Mexico. Unemployment dropped. Things stabilized a bit in terms of violence. And what ended up happening was you saw a significant drop in migration. Today, less than half the people across our border are from Mexico, and that's a direct result of the economic gains there. So it makes, look, every dollar we invest in Central America is going to save us, $3 to $4 to $5 in the United States. Doesn't mean we don't look at the aid and decide whether it's effective and maybe repackage it, but the worst thing we could do is cut off aid to those countries right now.
Right. Let's see if we can sneak in one last call. Peter's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Peter, you're on the air.
Yeah, and listen, by the way, I'm one of your conservative. You always do a great job to allow full full discussions. I'm an attorney, and not that means it, but the bottom line seems to me that with Trump, it's got to come either he's got executive power to make orders and to be superseded, and it needs to be adjudicated by the Supreme Court. I think he should come out with his best, hottest shots, suspend this catch and release, suspend all this, and just declare what he believes is a national emergency. And the issue is going to be by the Supreme Court. Does a district court judge from the Ninth Circuit or any other district court judge have the authority to say, I don't think it is? And you think it's a staggering implication. So if Trump, short of in somewhere else, decides to send troops in, short of declaring war, can some district court judge say, no, you can't do that?
Mm.
And I think it has to be a Supreme, and it should be a fast-track certiorari. I don't know I'm not an appellate guy, but it should be immediately up there, and I think he should suspend that, and either you're going to have a country with borders and enforced or you're not. And
okay.
That's my suggestion.
Yeah, Peter, thank you so much for your call. We just got a minute and a half left here to go, and just as a point, the president did declare a national emergency about the southern border here, and there are legal actions going on certainly around that as well. But Nick Miroff, listen, we have about a minute and a half left to go, and there's something that John Sandweg said a little earlier that I wanted your view on. And that is the question of whoever heads DHS moving forward is going to have to contend with the question of whether or not, how much authority they actually have, or whether that nexus of authority is going to lie with the White House. What's your view on that, and how central of an issue is that to the department moving forward?
Sure. I'll spin it forward a little bit. And yeah. I think the big question is this, we are heading into an election cycle, and You know, I'm not sure at this point what the calculation is in terms of who benefits politically if we continue to see, you know, a kind of chaotic situation, a crisis on the border with the numbers being what they are and so many people coming across. You know, I don't see a lot of motivation for Republicans and Democrats to get together on this. And so the question is going to be who will benefit politically, you know, as we move forward.
Yeah. Well, also, just as a note of context, the numbers right now are still far, far reduced from what they were in the early 2000s. There, that's also part of this picture that we ought to explore. And we will, I'm sure, in the coming weeks and months. So Nick Miroff, national security correspondent, covering immigration enforcement, drug trafficking, and the Department of Homeland Security for The Washington Post. Nick, it was great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And John Sandweg, former acting director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement under President Obama and a former top aide to then DHS Secretary Janet Napolitano. John Sandweg, it was terrific to have you. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.